This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Coming up is the mood on the West Papua question shifting at the Pacific Islands Forum. A story of hope emerges from the tribal violence in PNG's highlands and how cubes made in Melbourne could ramp up food security in those parts of the Pacific most affected by climate change. Good morning, I'm Richard Hewitt. Those stories to come a little later, but first Pacific leaders will try to hammer out a consensus on climate change in a private meeting at the Pacific Islands Forum in Tuvalu today. Earlier in the week, the group of smaller island states signed a declaration calling on countries to improve their emissions reduction targets and phase out the use of coal in the power sector rapidly. But as the discussions continue, New Zealand has been caught in the middle of the Pacific's push and Australia's push back. Foreign Affairs reporter Melissa Clark is in Tuvalu, and when I spoke to her a short time ago, I asked her if she thought an agreement on climate change would be possible after the leaders' retreat.
There is a chance that they can come to a consensus position. The de facto starting point has really become the smaller island states' Tuvalu declaration, which they signed earlier in the week before Australia and New Zealand arrived. And there is some room to come to an agreement on the language around the ambition for tougher emissions reduction targets for countries if some of the terms are adjusted so they're not so absolute. Certainly the smaller island states want that Tuvalu declaration to be the basis for the Pacific Island Forum agreement here. But there are those sticking points, such as the time frame on phasing out the use of coal in the power sector, and other elements like the use of carryover credits already appear to be something that are being backed away from. The insistence that countries not use carryover credits was in the Nandi Bay Declaration that was signed by the Pacific Islands Development Forum a couple of weeks ago. That language has already been backed away from in the Tuvalu Declaration. So the fact that some of those tougher requests from Pacific leaders are being stepped back from will help get Australia to agree to a statement. So consensus is possible, but it's certainly not going to be easy.
Does Australia have particular support, though, in pushing back against some of these points of contention?
Look, New Zealand has been at pains not to take sides, but Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern does seem to be a little stuck in the middle at the moment. She's tried to support Pacific countries, saying that all nations need to reassess their targets to make sure their contribution to the global effort is adequate. But she's also echoed some of Australia's reluctance to refund the Green Climate Fund, Australia's reservations on that front. She did say Australia has to answer to the Pacific, but she did so in her efforts to evade giving a direct answer on whether she thought Australia's current emissions reduction targets were actually adequate. So she's stuck in the middle. Mr. Morrison is trying to secure other support and talk other Pacific leaders around to Australia's points of view. He had about five bilateral meetings within the first couple of hours of arriving in Tuvalu yesterday, and we've been told Papua New Guinea and the Cook Islands prime ministers expressed an interest in a consensus communique. So at the moment, the Pacific leaders appear to be stepping towards some middle ground. We're yet to see such movement from Australia, but at the leaders' retreat today, they'll be trying to nut it out. It could end up being a long day.
And ultimately, what is the significance of the final communique when it comes, and in particular, I imagine, the actual form of words contained therein?
Yeah, so this Pacific Island Forum leaders' statement or communique or whatever level of statement they decide to agree upon will be taken to a United Nations Forum on Climate Action next month in New York. Now, the UN Secretary General has helped bring attention to the plight of Pacific countries facing climate change. So Pacific countries want to leverage that interest to get the rest of the world's attention too. But if they can't bring a strong statement for action from the major regional body in the Pacific itself, it makes it all the harder to prosecute the case for stronger global action. So that's why there's been such a push in the lead up to this meeting from Pacific leaders to try and get an agreement on a really strongly worded statement.
That's our Foreign Affairs reporter Melissa Clark in Tuvalu for the Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Retreat, and mentioned there the stance being adopted by New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. Here's some of what she had to say to the media covering the forum meeting on Tuvalu.
Like our Pacific Island neighbours, we will continue that international call. We will continue to say that New Zealand will do its bit, and we have an expectation that everyone else will as well. We have to. New Zealand, relative to other nations, has a relatively small emissions profile. However, if we all took the perspective that if you're small, it doesn't matter, we wouldn't see change. Every single little bit matters. And so that is why New Zealand has joined that international call. It is why we speak, I believe, strongly on the international stage around these issues. But ultimately, we all have to take responsibility ourselves. My reference was to the fact that Australia has to answer to the Pacific. That is a matter for them.
New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. Now, still at the Pacific Islands Forum on the key issue of West Papua, there appears to be a wind of change with some unexpected comments from unexpected quarters. During a session with the civil society organisation Samoa's Prime Minister Tuilepi Salele said the issue cannot be ignored anymore when people are dying. While Tonga's leader Akalisi Pohiva asked, has the Pacific lost control of its own destiny, and suggested that Indonesia looks at the region like nothing. So is this just rhetoric, or does the fact that Polynesian leaders are speaking out in this way on a Melanesian cause mean we can anticipate a strong statement on West Papuan self-determination in the final communique? George Carter is a former political advisor at the US Embassy in Apia and now a research fellow at the Australian National University. He's in Tuvalu for the forum and was in the room for the West Papua session.
It was Tonga's Prime Minister, Dr. Akalisi Pohiva, that sort of changed the mood in the room. With a passionate outcry in the meeting, with the opening remarks, he asked whether regionalism was real and whether it was only a myth. And he situated these questions to explain the region's need for collective response, whereby the past response has been something of sitting on the fence. And, you know, he calls upon how can we reconcile and live with the facts of West Papua as a region. And it seems like we have given our destiny to others, and by others have been the United Nations, to look into the issue. He was calling upon the leaders in today's retreat to please consider their solidarity. This is the solidarity was their only weapon in addressing the West Papua issue. Now, immediately afterwards, the Prime Minister of Samoa, Tuilepi Salele-Milianoi, stated on the West Papua question that leaders will have imperfect views, but we must take certain positions. And he called upon, you know, some of the countries to reevaluate these positions. He stated that these challenges to him were pressing and that all leaders need to address the issue with courage.
If we assume that, for example, Vanuatu, which is at the vanguard of pushing the West Papuan cause, continues to bang the drum, and maybe Solomon Islands, which has spoken out in the past, although we're not quite sure where they stand on key issues these days, but maybe something will come out of the leaders' retreat, something unexpected on West Papua that might completely shift the agenda here.
We may see that. And yesterday's response, Prime Minister Gowari, but as well as Foreign Minister Regnemanuel Vanuatu, he sort of spoken out and said that beyond having a united front or solidarity towards West Papua, it's important that if we do have such a position in the communique, and that's Foreign Minister Regnemanuel, that leaders also encourage that we continue to voice this in other forums, and that it's not solely one or two countries speaking on these issues. But there's been a lot of drafting and a lot of negotiations, and having some movement in the communique that's different from the past years. What we are starting to hear that the foreign ministers have agreed, sort of are now taking it up to the leaders, is to press upon that it's not just within the decolonization list, but it's also something to be addressed within the UN Human Rights Council.
Given the comments that have come particularly from unexpected sources like the Prime Minister of Samoa, the Prime Minister of Tonga, how do you see the prospect for a strong, unified statement on the issue of West Papua coming out in the final communique?
We will probably see something in the middle ground, but with some movement. What we saw yesterday, and from particular countries such as Samoa, who have not been vocal on the issue, calling upon other leaders to review their stances, is something to look forward to in from today. I think the other thing too, the main key player in the West Papua issue is Papua New Guinea's stance and what Merape sees as the way forward into the policy towards West Papua will actually be the one that the region will move to. And as of yesterday, Merape, in his statement, put the right not to respond on the issue during the session. And so while we see from Samoa the need for leaders to move forward or rethink stances on the issue of West Papua, I think the key player in all of this will be Papua New Guinea and how they see West Papua and how it should be addressed as a region.
George Carter, former political advisor at the US Embassy in Apia, now a research fellow at the Australian National University, with reflections on that session on the sidelines of the Pacific Islands Forum in Tuvalu yesterday. Now, an Australian missionary accused of indecently assaulting young girls in Solomon Islands has pleaded not guilty to all charges in the Honiara Magistrates Court. 72-year-old Kevin Reitveld is facing multiple counts of indecent assault on five girls below the age of 15, and a trial date has been set for early next year. Evan Wasuka spoke to reporter Georgina Kakea in Honiara after the hearing.
There were nine counts listed against him of indecent assault. And to all those nine counts, he pleaded not guilty to all those charges laid against him. So basically, this was for him to just make his plea and also to have a trial date set down, and also just some other details which the magistrate has, especially with regards to mentions and bail application and all that.
Now, tell us about the trial date. When is the trial being set for?
The trial is being set down for the 10th to the 21st of February 2020. In Solomon Islands, there has been a backlog of cases, and also Christmas in December. And then the magistrate does set down the trial date for the 10th to 21st of February as the dates for the trial of the case into the indecent assault allegedly conducted by the Australian missionary. So, yeah, it's been set down for the 10th to 21st Feb.
And you mentioned that there were some conditions imposed by the magistrate's court. Can you tell us what they were?
Earlier on, there was a bail application which they had approved, and the prosecution this morning has applied for variations into the bail. I think they want the accused not to go beyond East Honiara, where the complainants live, especially towards the airport area, Henderson. And they've also asked that the accused not mingle or be in close contact with girls under the ages of 18. And they've also asked that the accused go down to Central Police Station every Friday to present himself to police. But to those three applications, the magistrate refused the application, saying that it's already encompassed inside the conditions set out in the bail applications.
The accused is out on bail right now. Will there be any further court appearances before the trial set for February next year?
There'll be interim mentions, but he's not expected to attend. He's been excused to attend the interim mentions. There are six set down, like one for each month, except for the final one on the 27th of Jan.
That's reporter in Honiara, Georgina Kakea, speaking there to Evan Wasuka.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Richard Hewitt with you for a Thursday morning. A massacre in the PNG Highlands last month was just the latest example of violence linked to long-running land disputes. But amid the reports of brutality and murder is an extraordinary story of survival. A Papua New Guinean teenager who was deliberately and severely burnt in a fire as a baby has found a new life in Melbourne. Emai Owen, her mother Elsie, and Emai's Australian carer Jeff Clark have shared their story for the first time with our reporter Susie Rains.
When Emai was just 5 months old, she was badly burnt on a fire in her mother's village. The village in Eastern Highlands Province is so remote it can't be found on a map, and it took Emai's parents 5 hours to carry her tiny body to the nearest hospital.
They said, I think in their own words, that it's not worth trying to save her. So basically just there wasn't anything they could do, just telling my parents that they should just let me die.
It was in that hospital at Goroka that Emai languished for almost a year before she was found by an Australian nurse and transported to Melbourne. Since then, Emai has gone to extraordinary lengths to live an ordinary life. She lives in an inner city suburb that bears no resemblance to the village where she was born.
Beaches with friends, Point Leo.
Doing nippers.
But I also believe that in every bad situation, there comes a good situation out of it. So me getting burnt in a fire, yes, that was heartbreaking and bad and made me disabled, but at the same time, I got to come to Australia, got the medical operations, and also have a great education.
When she was small, she sometimes got stared at by other small kids, and she found that distressing, but that's all past now. So I think she's, in a way, had a very normal life to date, other than all the surgeries she's had.
It's taken no less than 19 reconstructive surgeries to help Emai reach her physical potential. And along the road to her recovery, she was granted a protection visa and eventually Australian citizenship in recognition of the danger she might face if she was sent back home.
Certainly, there was a significant underlying sort of problem of sorcery being sort of believed in. And, you know, people with injuries or disabilities bringing bad luck to the village.
Her family says their village is still not safe for Emai because of tribal violence relating to an ongoing land dispute.
It's certainly a good reason not to go back, and it's not a good reason for me to go anywhere near that village. It's scary, very scary. Violence is big. My uncle on my dad's side, he got shot because of that. Both grandparents were poisoned.
I am happy because if she hadn't gone to Australia, she would have had big problems.
She was born with spirit, I think, and she tackles everything with spirit, and that's lovely to see. I think that's been her greatest blessing, is that she's got this great inner strength and self-belief, really.
Do I wish that it never happened? No. That probably seems like a pretty odd thing to say, but if I didn't get burnt in that fire, I wouldn't be here.
The remarkable story of Emai Owen and the reporter there for Pacific Beat, Susie Rains. Now, one of the most concerning aspects of climate change in the Pacific is food security, but a system developed by a small private business based in Melbourne is offering a way forward for communities where poor soil, water scarcity and sea level rise make it impossible to grow fresh produce. Biofilter's Food Cube technology has already proved itself at a household level in Australia, but now a much bigger project is being trialled in Tuvalu, which of course is hosting this week's Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Meeting. And with some 200 of them installed in front yards and school grounds, the chief executive of Biofilter, Mark Noyce, says the food cubes will be hard for the visiting political leaders to miss.
Well, the food cube is essentially a very large self-watering pot plant. Only what we've done is we've modularised food growing into square metre containers that can be connected, and then that gives you a large array of food growing opportunities so that they water themselves and they have what's called a wicking system. So instead of a traditional garden bed where it waters from the top down and then goes into the soil below, our sealed systems water from the bottom up with a wicking system.
So therefore I assume this is a go anywhere system, is it? And hence the connection with Tuvalu.
Because it's a sealed system, the soil and the water is perched above the ground. You can then grow food in places where food just can't really grow. Tuvalu is very difficult to grow vegetables because salt water comes out the ground in a high tide, and that makes growing vegetables really, really difficult.
How easy is it to set up this system? Because I presume to produce large quantities of food, you're going to need large quantities of cubes, aren't you?
Our system has been designed so that it's easy to ship, and what it can do is it can rapidly deploy modules. You connect them up. It's a bit like a Lego brick system. There's not very much to do in terms of setup, and you then just put in your compost or your growing media, add water and grow plants.
But in order to get to this point, you fought off competition from around about 280 different applications from around the world, I believe, who all have their own ideas on how to produce food in difficult circumstances.
It's actually pretty cool that Australian invention, going up against some of the best ideas across the world, was selected because of its simplicity. A lot of technologies are looking for very high-tech solutions. Ours is a very low-tech solution, which you can use compost and green waste and closing nutrient loops. And you can do that at a home scale, but you can also do that at a community and city scale. And we're showing that ourselves, where we're growing enough food for an average adult in the space of a car park.
Cost, I imagine, comes into it. Is it a relatively cheap thing to do, or is there a cost element here that a country like Tuvalu would have to think twice about?
That's a very interesting question. We've got our products injection molded in Melbourne, which means we can rapidly make these products using recycled food grade plastic that was headed for landfill. And because we can make them very quickly, we can get the price right down. So for around $350, you can have a system that can grow over 30 kilos worth of food per annum in a very small footprint and save water by having it stored and giving it to the plants as they need it. It's not inexpensive, but in Tuvalu, if you don't have a lot of food options to grow at home, it's an investment for the whole family.
And presumably also with a country like Tuvalu, there may be international assistance available to get something like the Food Cube up and running on a large scale?
That's correct. We're doing trials in Tuvalu to demonstrate that the food growing technique with the sealed wicking system works, and there's government assistance to look at scaling that up and making food options and importing food not so much of an issue anymore. We've got hundreds of families now accessing green food. Green food meaning vegetables that just wouldn't have been an option. It's not going to replace broadacre farming. We're not trying to do that, but this is a solution that can help feed populations at risk.
That's Mark Noyes, who's Chief Executive of Biofilter, based in Melbourne, and trialling their food cubes with some success in Tuvalu, host nation for this week's Pacific Island Forum Leaders Meeting. Finally, on this edition of Pacific Beat, for many years, buying a piece of award-winning Indigenous art was something most people in Australia couldn't afford, but in the last few years, fashion made with fabrics from remote art centres have gone mainstream, and these days you can pick up items like shorts or skirts for as little as $100. And now, as Amelia Turzan reports, a major Australian chain store is collaborating with Indigenous artists whose collections are launching in Darwin.
It's the final encore of a fashion parade at an auditorium in Darwin. Standing on stage, surrounded by models in colourful dresses and skirts, is an Aboriginal elder sitting in a wheelchair. The traditional stories of Tommy May's culture have made it onto the catwalk after a fashion line co-produced with the label Gorman.
And I know my stories from my grandfather, mother, very important to me.
The idea of a fashion line was first pitched to Tommy May and four other senior artists from Munkajar Arts in Fitzroy Crossing 2 years ago.
We had, big meeting. We learned about idea, what we can do.
Gorman's creative director, Lisa Gorman, has collaborated with about 80 artists during her career, but this was the first time she worked with Indigenous ones. She'd wanted to do this for years, but it didn't feel right.
It was predominantly my nervousness around the cultural sensitivity of working with ancient language. I wasn't equipped, I didn't want to mess it up.
She decided to take the jump after figuring out how to go ahead with legal structures around copyright.
There's less nervousness around, appropriation and things like that because it can be done properly.
And Gorman isn't the only fashion brand that's taking Indigenous fabrics to the masses. Darwin Aboriginal Art Fair Foundation Executive Director Claire Summers says she noticed the trend take off during the GFC.
We saw this really affect the high-end market, and art centres right across Australia have been diversifying their businesses. So while things were difficult in the fine art market, the development of textiles erupted.
Other labels collaborating with remote communities include North, Verna and Magpie Goose, which staged a pop-up shop in Darwin this month, selling pieces featuring designs by Jones Billy from Inyeri.
Dresses, I think, and shirts, that's with the nailfish design on it. We call it, in Alawa, we call it Barun Barun.
And what's it like when you see people try on clothing that's made from fabric of your designs?
It's pretty amazing, seeing people that coming up and buying our stuff and, that we're sharing our culture and our design with other people.
When it comes to economically supporting the artist by fashion, there's many different models that are being used. Magpie Goose's model is giving each artist a lump payment for a fabric design. This works out to them getting about 10% of the overall takings. Meanwhile, from Gorman's collection, it's giving artists a confidential payment for each artwork that's turned into clothing, as well as another confidential cut of the clothing sales to help fund youth projects in their community. Jones Billy says it would be hard for his remote community to launch its own fashion line without help from bigger companies.
Where it comes from is pretty remote.
Is there a point that one day you'd like to take over the whole business?
I think so, yeah. One day.
Jones Billy handing that report from Amelia Tizen on a burgeoning Indigenous fashion industry up there in Darwin. And that rounds out this edition of Pacific Beat. As far as the morning is concerned, Evan Wasuka will be along at 3:05 Eastern Australian time with the afternoon edition. I'm Richard Hewitt. Thanks very much indeed, as always, for your company. Coming up next, it's Talia with Pacific Mornings.